Welcome to the vast assembly filling the hall for another Denko-e session. A session of sitting and gathering the light and transmitting the light, looking at Keizan Zenji's stories of the Zen ancestors. So, do y'all know the Denko Roku, the record of transmitting the light? So, Keizan, you know Dogen, yeah? Dogen, our founding ancestor, four generations after Dogen, was a teacher named Keizan Jokin was born and maintained the Soto Zen lineage, and he compiled this record of the ancestors of the lineage and their awakening stories, and it's called the Record of Transmitting the Light. And nowadays in Soto Zen, these are considered the two founding ancestors, Dogen and Keizan. And we study Dogen a lot and talk a lot about Dogen, but Keizan is, I think, underestimated in our Soto tradition. His teachings are quite wonderful. And so in Japanese Soto Zen, they say Dogen's Shobogenzo, the treasury of the true Dharma eye, and Keizan's Denko Roku, the record of transmitting the light, are like the two foundational texts of Soto Zen. So this is really, this is the style of our house. And Keizan's teaching is a little different than Dogen's. Very similar, but a little different flavor, as we'll see this week. So before jumping into the first story, just to set the stage, this is a little bit about the style of Keizan's teaching about the light. So this is the introduction by Francis Cook, the translator. And he's talking about how Keizan has lots of different names for this light that the book is about. A number of names or epithets are given this light, such as that one, that person, the undying Lord of the Hermitage, and several others. It's likened to a pearl that's bright and lustrous without need for carving and polishing. A vermilion boat so beautiful that no artist could capture its beauty in a painting. The wind which circulates everywhere and shakes the world, but that cannot be seen or touched. An icy spring so deep no traveler can make out its bottom. These are some images for this light. And then here's some qualities of this light. The more I study Dogen and Keizan, the more I feel that Dogen is really emphasizing emptiness teachings, and Keizan's really emphasizing Buddha nature teachings. Tathagata Garbha is the heart of the Tathagata, even the womb of the Buddhas, is another name for Buddha nature, this tradition of our true nature being perfectly complete, radiant, and empty. But here, I think this translator, Francis Cook, does a beautiful job of compiling a bunch of different qualities of this light And he names like a whole bunch of different chapters of this book and that talk about this light, and he pulls out different descriptions of it. So this, I'm not going to read which chapter each one from is from. If you're interested in this, it lists all the numbers. But this is just a description throughout this whole text about this light. Every chapter pretty much is about it. So this is the translator speaking. It is this old fellow whom we all truly and essentially are, says Kazan. Or we might say, this old gal. This true self has been our constant companion in life after life and has never left us. We're referring to like our Buddha nature. Self with a capital S. There's no independent self in Buddha's teaching, but in Zen sometimes they talk about this. And in the sutras they talk about Buddha nature as this true self, selfless self. Here are some qualities that Kazan mentions. It's beyond all predication, such as pure and impure, annihilation or eternity, and it's identical in fools and sages. It itself never divides itself into self and other, or subject and object, but merely wears the faces of self and other. Mind, the objective world, delusion, and awakening are all nothing but names for one's true self. All that we are and do is the result of its presence. It gives us life and makes us die. And we see and hear through the presence of this faceless fellow, faceless gal. It is the source of our minds and bodies. Even the use of ordinary discriminative thinking is the doing of this true self. It itself is speechless and mindless. It has no form or sense faculties, but it is not mere nothingness or emptiness. It is, on the contrary, a reality possessed by all beings and the true place to which we all return. Although we are born here and die there, constantly arriving and departing in the cycle of birth and death, this true self does not die, nor is it reborn, but remains eternally the undying lord of the house, who merely wears different faces of ordinary beings, Buddhas, demons, and donkeys. When the world is periodically destroyed by fire, water, and wind, it is not destroyed. In humans, it is nothing but bright light, clear, distinct knowing. So each one of those sentences is like some qualities of this true nature in throughout different chapters. And this book, The Transmission of Light Record, was, we're pretty sure, spoken by Kazan and recorded by his students, and copied sometimes by hand in this early generations after Kazan, and then basically lost. It got kind of like stored away on the shelves of just a few Soto monasteries in Japan and never published, and just collected dust. And Soto Zen practitioners didn't know about this book after Kazan's time until the 1800s. Some Soto Zen priest discovered it on some dusty shelf in a temple and published it. In the 1800s, Kazan lived in the 1300s, so for 500 years, this was unknown book, which is now considered one of the two main texts of our tradition. I think that's kind of amazing in itself. And then once it was published in the 1800s, people were like, wow, this is amazing. And then people maybe started looking around their dusty shelves and the backs of temples, and they found some other manuscripts in the 1900s. I think they, in some Soto temple in Japan, they found the earliest handwritten copy of this text, which they could date by the, kind of like by the language used and so on, from just around Keizan's time. So for a while, people weren't sure if this was written maybe way later and just attributed to Keizan, but when they found this old one, they said, well, actually, this is from Keizan's time. But then it changed. It was edited over time. There's a lot about the history in here, but that's the basic gist. So it starts with these... this is Keizan. It starts with the first teacher in our lineage, Shakyamuni Buddha. And each chapter is a like a koan case, a story, and then the some circumstances of that ancestor's life, and then Keizan's teisho, or like Dharma talk about the story, and then Keizan's verse at the end to cap it off. So the story, and each one is the story of this ancestor's pivotal moment of awakening to the light. It's quite wonderful that these moments are singled out and celebrated. So Shakyamuni Buddha, there's different versions of his awakening, but this is the one here. Shakyamuni Buddha saw the morning star and was awakened to the way and said, I and the great earth and all beings simultaneously achieve the way. That's the story. So in the sutras, there's many stories about the Buddha's life and awakening. And I found it interesting that this story of the seeing the morning star, maybe we've all heard this as Zen people, but this does not appear in the sutras anywhere. This is a Zen story of Buddha seeing the morning star. The sutras do talk about the Buddha sitting with great diligence throughout the night and the different watches of the night. He opens to more and more aspects of reality, and his final complete awakening is at dawn. So in the old sutras, the Buddha's awakening was at dawn, but seeing the morning star is a little Zen addition. And it's kind of nice that maybe all of these other Zen ancestors' awakenings are always a meeting. The awakenings always happen. They never happen to somebody sitting zazen and having an insight. Isn't that interesting? They always happen in a meeting, usually with someone else. Occasionally there's a meeting with a non-human, like there's a meeting with peach blossoms or a meeting with a pebble striking a bamboo. But almost always the meetings are with another person. So maybe that could be part of why in the Zen tradition they're like, well, for the Buddha's awakening, we can't have it just be him sitting zazen alone. We have to have a meeting. And there was no other Buddhas around before him. The six previous Buddhas were not visible at that time. So, but the morning star was. He could meet the morning star, meet another. And in Chinese, the characters for translated as morning star are bright star, bright or luminous star. And if you look that up in the dictionary, the Chinese dictionary, it says like what we call morning star, but it actually says Venus, which is what our morning star is too, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about the morning star, but it's actually not a star. And I don't know, in Keizan's time, they probably thought it was a star and not a planet. But I think it's a nice little twist, maybe, in modern times, that the Buddha saw the morning star, but actually it wasn't a star. The Buddha was awakened when he saw what we call a star, but he actually didn't see a star. Venus. What's so great about Venus? Well, it's rising first and shining best. When he saw this, he was awakened to the way and said, I, the great earth, and all beings simultaneously achieve the way, or at the same time. Another translation, instead of saying, I and the great earth and beings, says, I and all beings on the great earth. Which maybe is more concise and simple. But we could also include the great earth itself. Maybe that's like, includes all inanimate beings as well as animate. And this part of like, at the Buddha's awakening, I, together with, and at the same time as all beings and the great earth, we awaken to the way, which is, you know, awaken to the way, or realize the way is this awakening. And this part about the simultaneity and all beings together, we don't find that in the Pali Canon version of the Buddha's awakening either. It's a single, solitary awakening. But in the Mahayana Sutras, we don't really have this story, but I think this story is maybe influenced by a very well-known Mahayana story from the Avatamsaka Sutra, the flower ornament scripture, in chapter 37, called Manifestation of the Tathagata. And this sutra is supposedly, this is just a tiny bit of this huge sutra, which was said to be taught by the Buddha immediately after his awakening under the Bodhi tree. This whole sutra kind of came forth while sitting under the Bodhi tree, while there was still nobody around except for lots of celestial beings and so on. So we could say that this was kind of like, the whole sutra is the Buddha's first words at his awakening. And in chapter 37 of this first words, the Buddha, that's a leaf from the Bodhi tree under which the sutra was taught. And the Buddha says, children of the Buddha, the wisdom of the Tathagata is also thus boundless and unobstructed, universally able to benefit all sentient beings. It's fully present within the bodies of sentient beings. But those who are ignorant, prone to false thinking and attachments, do not know this, are not aware of it, and thus do not obtain benefit. Then the Tathagata, with his unobstructed, pure eye of wisdom, universally beholds all sentient beings in the universe and says, strange. How strange. How can it be that although all sentient beings are fully possessed of the wisdom of the Tathagata, because of their ignorance and confusion, they neither know nor see that? I should teach them the noble path, thus enabling them to forever drop away their false thoughts and attachments and perceive the great wisdom of the Tathagata within themselves, not different from the Buddha's. So this phrase is often quoted as one of the highlights of the sutra, where the Buddha looks at out at all these beings and says, they're all fully possessed of the wisdom of the Tathagata. So he sees their Buddha nature. Before that, he's just a bunch of ignorant beings, and I'm ignorant too, but at least I'm making an effort here. And at this awakening, all these beings are completely perfected, as well as myself. Perfectly radiant light, but because of their habitual patterns and tendencies, and such as like doubt and low self-esteem and all kinds of things, they're like, well, this can't be Buddha here. Therefore, I'm going to keep teaching this sutra and many other sutras for the rest of my life to help awaken them to who they already are. So it's kind of a Buddha nature teaching. He saw their Buddha nature. And he says, but there's these habitual tendencies. The Zen people may be influenced by that story. I feel like Keizan's story here is based on that, but he doesn't even say, but. He doesn't even say, but they're still all obscured. He just says, the Buddha in this story says, I, the great earth and all beings, simultaneously achieve the way, or attain the way, jodo, become the way, together. So it's taking it a step further than the sutra. It's really saying, not only do they have this Buddha nature, but it's obscured. It's saying the Buddha's insight was that we all realize the way. I mean, we can say, but I don't feel like that. And all those beings on earth running around in their confusion, did they suddenly like stop? Wow, we realized the way. What happened? I've been on the other side of the world from the Bodhi tree. Maybe not, but I think it's provocative and part of the Zen style to emphasize this. They really did completely touch the way. Not even so much at that moment. It kind of sounds that way, but I hear it more as, I see that we really are all touching the way every moment.
Well, yeah. Some big event happens in one part of the world and then it's being recognized by Krishna on the other side of the planet. So it could have been, we just didn't notice.
Yeah, we could hear it like that, yeah. That actually there was this totally significant event under that Bodhi tree at that time for everybody.
And then habits kept going.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's even less personal. Mm-hmm. To me it says, I see the all-pervading nature that pervades everything.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot be separate. That's
right. We cannot be separate, yeah. And whether or not something vibrated throughout the universe, particularly strongly at that time, or not, we don't know. But there actually are sutras too that Lalita Vistara Mahayana Sutra of the Buddha's Awakening does kind of imply that actually this light, like, pervaded all these world systems at the time of Buddha's Awakening, and beings did notice something different at that time. So, and in a way, we have nothing to compare to, because Shakyamuni Buddha lived a long time ago. We could say, isn't this room bright now? You could say, well, maybe before Shakyamuni Buddha lived, if we were sitting in this room, it would have been like kind of murky and hazy and dull. But Shakyamuni Buddha 2,500 years ago, like this brightness that he discovered pervades this room even now. So. That's the story. Now the circumstances, the celebration of the Buddha's life and brief form, but this is Keizan, our Soto ancestor speaking. He says, Shakyamuni Buddha was of the sun race in India, and I don't know, I never heard of this elsewhere, but the Surya Vamsa, the sun lineage, and one tradition says that Shakyamuni Buddha's family ancestors were descended from the sun, and there were other families in India descended from the moon. And this is not about like the caste system or anything, it's just probably Indian legend. But kind of nice to go with the transmission of light is that the Buddha's, you know, blood ancestors descended from the, from this blazing ball of light and fire we call the sun. At the age of 19, according to this Zen story, because in the Pali Sutras, Buddha left home at age 29, but here, at the age of 19, he leapt over the palace walls in the dead of night, and at Mount Dantaloka, he cut off his hair, and left all his, you know, princely ornaments. Subsequently, he practiced austerities for 6 years. Later, he sat on the Vajra seat under the Bodhi tree, where spiders spun webs in his eyebrows and magpies built a nest on top of his head. This is just, I think, emphasizing how still he sat for such a long time that spiders could weave webs on his body. Reeds grew up between his legs as he sat tranquilly and erect without movement for 6 years. So it's kind of, in this story, he practiced these austerities for 6 years, and then he kind of he ate some rice porridge, and that was enough to sustain him for 6 more years, where he just sat without moving. That wasn't the austerity part. I think the austerity part was maybe like starving himself and trying to not breathe and these various things that Buddha talks about in the early sutras. It's like all that extra stuff, I think it's what I trust most, I imagine the Buddha saying, is just sitting, dropping off body and mind, and I'm going to clarify this light and not going to arise until it's completely clarified and there's complete continuity. At the age of 30, in the Pali Canon they say at 35, on the 8th day of the 12th month that we call Rohatsu, as the morning star appeared, he was suddenly awakened, enlightened. These words from the story above are his very first lion's roar. In other words, I, the great earth, and all beings, at the same time, achieve the way. From that time on, for 49 years, he did not spend a day alone, but taught the Dharma for the assembly constantly. I think Keizan was kind of into this. Later he critiques, maybe there were people in his assembly who thought, I want to go off and be a hermit alone. And Keizan says, that's too easy for you. You should stay with these difficult people. And in the sutras, I think the Buddha was almost always around people, although he occasionally there's stories of him going off on retreat alone. When he got fed up with people. But here he says, he never spent even a day alone, but he taught the Dharma for the assembly constantly. He was never without robe and bowl. Or another translation is, with one robe and one bowl, he lacked nothing. During that time, he taught to the assembly more than 360 times. I think way more, 360 times. Later, he transmitted the treasury of the true Dharma eye to Mahakashyapa, and it's been passed down from Mahakashyapa through generation after generation to the present. Truly, it's been transmitted through India, China, and Japan, where the practice of the true Dharma is based on it. The practices of the Buddha's lifetime are the standards for his descendants. Even though he possessed the 32 marks and the 80 minor marks of a Buddha, he certainly looked like an ordinary old monk and was no different from other people. The sutras talk about this Indian tradition of these 32 marks of these great beings, such as Dharma wheels on the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet, and really long earlobes, and a little tuft of hair between the eyes, and all the hairs kind of curled, and all kinds of other physical signs and marks.
Is that just supposed to happen?
I think that actually it doesn't happen at the time of enlightenment, that they already, even in the worldly attainments from previous lives, I would understand it. Because I think the Pali Canon version is when the sage found the baby Buddha, he said he has these marks. Mm-hmm. They weren't maybe fully developed, but you could see he has these 32 marks, which means he's either going to be a Buddha or like a world ruler, Chakravartin king, wheel-turning king. But I think it's a good point that they're... Who cares if you have wheel marks on your hand? They're worldly marks. The Buddha has other marks of his realization. But this is the tradition. 32 major marks and 80 minor marks. But he actually just looked like an ordinary old monk. No different from anyone else, Keizan is emphasizing. Therefore, after his appearance in the world, throughout the three times of the true Dharma, the counterfeit Dharma, and the present collapsed Dharma, or Dharma ending age. You heard about this before? These three times of Dharma. It's nice to just know about this. I appreciated this footnote. That Buddhist sutras have the Buddha predicting that his teaching will pass through these three periods, during which the authenticity and integrity of both the teaching and the Sangha would degenerate. So you find this in these old sutras. The first period, the period of the true Dharma, is self-explanatory. The true Dharma, the time of the Buddha and shortly afterwards. It would last for 500 years. This would be followed by a period called the counterfeit Dharma. Like counterfeit money, it looks genuine, but there's only the outward show. In reality, the teachings are not well taught or understood, and there's a serious decline in monastic life. Interesting, I think, because these kind of things do happen after the Buddha's time. It's easy to create the outer appearances of practice and forms and sangha, but what's really happening? I can hear it as an encouraging teaching to, like, let's be careful. The third period, or the collapse dharma, mappo in Japanese, or the age of decline, sometimes translated. During this period, human morality and ability will have generated so far, and the Dharma itself become so corrupted that there be no hope for liberation or enlightenment. So sad. The Japanese calculated this final period to begin at the end of the 11th century. I think there's different stories, but this is Dogen and Keizan's time. Is this age of decline? Keizan's response to this Mappo, age of decline is typical of the way that Zen teachers, starting with Dogen, dealt with the problem. A response diametrically opposite to that of the new faith-oriented Pure Land Buddhism founded by Honen and Shinran. This is, I think this is a nice history to know. That Honen and Shinran, this Pure Land school, they like, was based largely on this idea of that this is the age of decline, it's hopeless. People don't have enough, like, diligence to realize the way anymore. It's too corrupt. But we need Buddha Dharma, so we can't do it ourselves because it's the age of decline, they said, these Pure Land founders of Japan. We can't do it, but if we rely on Amitabha Buddha, total faith in Amitabha Buddha, that when we die, we'll be born in this Pure Land due to the power and grace of Amitabha Buddha. That was the style at the same time as Dogen. And as the note says, Dogen and the other Zen teachers didn't really like that. I think they appreciated some of that view, but they were more like, the age, Dogen says elsewhere, the age of decline or non-decline is only made by the people living in it at that time. So it's kind of like, it's not inherently impossible to realize the way. It maybe takes more effort, and we have to be more, maybe more self-reliant, because it's hard to find the true Dharma in the age of decline. But we need to make it the age of the true Dharma, even though it's, the sutras say this is the age of decline. That was the Zen style of, like, we got to go for it. And we rely on the Buddha also, but we don't completely turn over all our effort to the Buddhas. We make our effort, and then the Buddha meets us in that effort, and in that meeting, the way is realized. So our at noon service in Sesshin, we have this dedication where we say, we ask all these past awakened beings to support our practice, and we say, may the true Dharma be renewed in the age of decline. So that's based on this whole teaching at noon service. May the true Dharma age be renewed in this age of decline through our practice and through the help of the 16 arhats and so on. So Keizan likewise says here, therefore, after the Buddha's appearance in the world, throughout the three times of true Dharma, counterfeit Dharma, and the present age of decline, those who emulate the Buddha's teaching and conduct model themselves on his deportment. They use what he used, and each moment while walking about, standing in place, sitting or lying down, do as the Buddha did. Buddha after Buddha and ancestor after ancestor have simply transmitted this so that the true Dharma is not extinguished or cut off. And this event clearly indicates this. So that's Keizan's saying, well, by following the Buddha's example, we renew the true Dharma in the age of decline. And this event clearly indicates this. I think he means that Buddha is saying that I, the great earth and all beings, simultaneously achieve the way, we could even say throughout space and time, not just at that time, but up to the present and the infinite past and present. Therefore, this is possible to realize the way in the age of decline. Even though the method of expression, various stories, figures of speech and words was different on the more than 360 occasions during the 49 years of Buddha's teaching, they are nothing more than the expression of this principle. Say, all the Buddha's teachings are all expressions of I, the great earth and all beings, achieve the way simultaneously. That's the circumstances. Now here's Keizan's Teisho, is talk about the riffing on the main story. The so-called I in this main story, when the Buddha says, I am the great earth in all beings, and in Japanese this is ga, which is usually referring to like, really means like I or me, the self. So this so-called I is not Shakyamuni Buddha. And Shakyamuni Buddha also comes from this I. I, also the Buddha when he was born, we have this story, said, I alone am the world honored one. Same I that he then at his enlightenment spoke of. I and all beings on earth simultaneously achieved the way. The so-called I in this story is not Shakyamuni Buddha. And Shakyamuni Buddha comes from this I. So now we had all these expressions of different ways of talking about this light. I think in this story, the light is expressed by I. You could say this self. From which Shakyamuni Buddha comes. We know Buddha teaches anatman, no self. So we have to remember that we're not talking about some independent, singular, unchanging, truly existent self. But it gets pretty close here. Some people would say, too close for comfort. But others would say, go for it, Kazan. This I is not Shakyamuni Buddha, but Shakyamuni Buddha comes forth from this I. Not only does Shakyamuni come from it, but the great earth and all beings come from this I. Just as when a large net is taken up, and all the many openings of the net are also taken up. When Shakyamuni Buddha realized the way, the great earth and all beings also realized the way. Not just the great earth and all beings, but all the Buddhas of the past, future, and present were also greatly awakened. I think that's an interesting image of a net, like a fishing net, right? That when the net is taken up, all the many openings of the net are also taken up. And we have this image of Indra's net that's like a jewel net with every jewel reflecting every other jewel in this vast net. It's related, I think, to this. If you pick up one jewel, it comes with all the other jewels. And in this case, it's like, I just think it's a wonderful image of the Buddha's awakening is like this net that's like pervading the entire universe, lifted up. Almost like this is how the Buddha's vision is this boundless net with no edges or boundaries is lifted up or invigorated, and all the holes in the net are like every phenomenon in the entire universe. Everything is like a hole in the net. And you could say, why not say all the knots in the net are all lifted up? So I think it's just a metaphor, right? It's an image, but it's kind of interesting that we're talking about the holes in the net are lifted up. But the holes aren't anything. I mean, is it really, if you lift up a net, are the holes lifted up? Or are the holes left behind as the net's lifted up? So I just, when I contemplate that image, it's just, I think a subtle image about the space in between the knots in the net comes along with the net. So the net is Buddha's enlightenment and all the space that it surrounds, almost like Buddha's enlightenment is this net pervading all things, we could say, and the space between each node of Buddha's awakening, everything basically is pulled up with it. It sounds like that, in that metaphor, that something's lifted up. I don't know how far we want to stretch the metaphor, but it sounds like we might edit his metaphor if we feel like, do we want to say something's happening or not? We could also say when Buddha saw the net, or like awakened to the net, he saw that all the holes in it were also part of the net. But maybe Kazon just threw it out there on the spur of the moment without all its implications. But it's kind of implying like a fishing net miles and miles wide as you lift through the water. It's like you don't even know all the things that are being caught in this vast net. That's a good question, though. I think, is something happening or not?
Yeah. What's the issue with that? Is that you mean you got enlightened? Did something happen?
Yeah. Well, is that, what did you mean? Is that what you meant?
Yeah.
Did something happen there? Yeah.
As opposed to like people already enlightened.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Is it the seeing of enlightenment? Is that actually a doing?
Yeah.
Is that across a thing, or is it actually what is it, you know?
Yeah. And it's related to this earlier question too about did something happen at that time on the earth, right, where the white people really did notice something happening, or was it just like one person realized how reality is and realized that reality pervades everything, but actually nothing actually changed. What's that? Yeah, the dingy room story. Was it really the room was more dingy? I think this is a question. It's kind of like, did something happen? Yeah, I think this is a question for us. Yeah, and for us, for our own experience too, right? We could ask this, is the point of our practice for something to happen? To have some particular breakthrough realization after which everything is different? Or is it not really about something happening? Is it more about like perceiving the way things always have been and will be?
Or maybe it's a cause and effect all the way until you understand what cause and effect are.
Yeah, and until you understand that there's no cause and effect. There's cause and effect. There's still the appearance of cause and effect. There really seems to be cause and effect right up to the moment of seeing this is a conceptual construction, and then cause and effect still continues to appear as such. Yeah, and I think in Rinzai Zen, there's more emphasis on something happening, like Kensho, and you gotta get it, and breakthrough. Soto Zen, there's not as much emphasis on something particularly happening at a particular time and place, just because of the dangers of the duality, of setting that up as like, this thing is gonna happen, and then everything will be okay. There's problems with that way of thinking. Soto Zen is more in accord with non-duality of saying, we're not talking about some particular moment, just right now.
Well, did you talk about a meeting, yeah?
There's a meeting, yeah. And in fact, right, here's a book of particular moments. This is a book of particular moments of meeting, and they're celebrated. So I think we have that tension of these particular moments where it's realized that there's nothing special about this particular moment, and it's always been this way. And maybe we've all had moments that seem like a kind of freedom moment, where often it seems not so much that our inner commentary says, "Wow, totally amazing," just like who would have expected? It may be more like, "Wow, it really is true what the Buddhas and ancestors say, and it's not really something special at all. It's the way it's always been and the way it always has been for everybody." And yet, it really is clear how, when we let it be such, then we're released from our suffering. Almost like, I think this, the lord of the house, and these fancy terms like this are also sometimes called ordinary mind, like just so plain and simple. Some traditions say, it's so hard to realize this because it's so ordinary and we're looking somewhere else. It's so close to who we already are that we think it must be something different that will come in the future. And therefore we overshoot what's already the case. Since this is so, all Buddhas and beings realize the way throughout space and time simultaneously. Since this is so, do not think that it was just Shakyamuni Buddha who was enlightened or awakened. You must not see any Shakyamuni Buddha apart from the great earth and beings. Now, this is kind of what we've been talking about.
I was seeing your net thing to be like a fabric of,
yeah,
of reality.
Yeah, fabric of reality. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Unbroken fabric, unbounded fabric. Everything goes together. Nothing can be separated. That's the Buddha's insight. And therefore, there's no Shakyamuni Buddha apart from all beings on the great earth, or the great earth and all beings. Even though mountains, rivers, and their myriad forms flourish in great abundance, none of them are left out of Gotama's eye pupil. Gotama is the Buddha's family name. None of these mountains, rivers, and myriad forms are left out of the Buddha's eye pupil. Pupil?
An eye?
Yeah, E-Y-E. Eye pupil, meaning like the Buddha's wisdom eye, the true Dharma eye that sees this unbreakable fabric. How could anything in that fabric be outside of the Buddha's eye?
And I was just wondering, to which extent, how you're talking about meaning of two people or whatever, and I'm not the only differentiation that I hear here is actually the perspective, yeah? Like, do I have different perspectives, morning star, the different perspectives that I have, or whatever? But then
yeah.
I see that this differentiation, what is that? I mean, that's maybe breaking up to what the differentiation is.
Yeah. The appearance of differentiation and the fact that there's really not any differentiation at the same time. The two truths, the middle way, is that, wow, we're really different. But I think the Buddha's enlightenment also emphasizing at the same time as the myriad thing, mountains and rivers and the myriad things and people of this world have so much diversity. They're all part of this one fabric. They're all in the Buddha's eye pupil equally. And we could say that, the wisdom eye, in the Buddha, this wisdom eye, we could also say, is like this unbounded awareness that just receives everything like images on a mirror, right, where the images are differentiated, like there's red and blue are both reflected in the mirror, and yet they're completely identical in that they're just reflections on the mirror. Their actual nature is like not the slightest bit different. There's beautiful and ugly in the mirror, but from the perspective of the mirror, they're just all equally reflections. And we could say that's the Buddha's eye pupil, is the vast mirror that just receives the mountains, rivers, and earth. Nothing is excluded from this eye pupil of the Buddha. And then also there's all the suffering beings reflected on the surface of this mirror. No, I'm really suffering. You can't tell me this. I am Buddha because, like, don't you see my pain? It's real. That wisdom eye sees that too. Is like, no, they're really not suffering. They're so convinced they are. They're really not. But out of compassion, the Buddha's eye then doesn't just say, you're not suffering. It's too much. It says, well, tell me about it. Let's meet in the world of differentiation and really meet in where pain appears to sentient beings. And then the more we meet there, we see in that meeting that actually, what is this suffering I think is so unworkable? What if it's like a reflection on the mirror? What if it's the suffering is some light in Shakyamuni Buddha's eye pupil? All of you here, Keizan says, are also established in Gotama's eye pupil. Not only are you established in it, but rather it is enfolded within you. Buddha's eye is enfolded within you. Hard for me to.
Does it mean it's there?
Yeah, maybe just like it's pervading our bodies and minds. Enfolded. Enfolded within. Another translation of that is, not only are you established in it, but rather the eye has become you. Buddha's eye pupil has become you. So that's a little bit like, you are not Buddha's eye. Buddha's eye is you. You are not it. It actually is you.
I mean, just to extend the mirror image, it's an individual mirror samadhi. You know, it is not you.
Yeah. That's where that line comes from. Yeah, you are not it. In truth, it is you. I am not this person. I'm not the mirror. The mirror actually is this person, Kokyo. I think just emphasizing how the self will try to get a hold of anything. Yeah. Wow, I really see it. Actually, I am Buddha. But actually, the jewel mirror samadhi would say, it's not so much that you're Buddha, it's more that Buddha is you. Buddha's in charge. It's too bold to make a claim, I am Buddha, but say, Buddha can become me. That's a little less small self in there. That's, I think, a provocative line. You are not it. That's what this is talking about. It, in truth, is you. Or, not only are you in Buddha's eye, but rather the eye has become you. Also, Gotama's eye pupil becomes the fleshly body. Buddha's eye becomes this, you know, skin bag. It becomes the whole body of each person. Whole body here might also be like Zen Shin, whole body, like the complete, maybe even Dharma body. of each person, or the manifestation body of each person, standing like an 80,000 foot precipice in each one. So the eyeball becomes the whole body of each person, standing like an 80,000 foot precipice in each person. You know, some of this imagery is just, when you start to imagine, now the eye, Buddha's eye pupil, is now an 80,000 foot precipice inside this 6 foot body. I think it's just pushing our edges of what is possible. Therefore, do not think that from the past to the present there was a bright eye pupil and distinct people different from it. Do not think that there was Buddha's eye and then there were people. Because the people are the Buddha's eye and the Buddha's eye is the people. You are Gautama's eye pupil. Gautama is the entirety of each of you. Yeah. I hear it in almost each one of these stories, especially this one. And we'll stop here, but we can continue with this later, because in the next talk, he's going to really get into this point about the other I, the I, capital I, the me, and really start saying, what is this I, me, that gives rise to Shakyamuni Buddha? It's another name for, in this case, actually, the E-Y-E-I, the Buddha's E-Y-E-I and the Buddha's capital I-I are actually identical. But in English, they sound the same. So it's a nice story to remember as we're sitting period after period of zazen throughout the day, is I, simultaneously with all beings on great earth, achieve the way, realize the way. You know, Jodo doesn't realize as a more cognitive quality. I think it's a nice word, realize the way, but literally it's more like attain the way or become the way or touch the way. Which is maybe that phrase stuck in the Zen to emphasize that it's almost like beyond cognition. It's not necessarily limited to what we could call realize in a some sort of mental way, right? Just become the way. We all simultaneously become the way. And if we don't believe it while we're sitting, we could ask, why not? May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.